Hello and welcome again to Catholic Answers Focus. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and today we discuss one of those topics that really politically correct people would stay away from. A new thing has come into the world, gay marriage, and never before have there been fully legally and socially sanctioned gay parented families. All of these are facts, but they raise a question, maybe a dangerous question for some people, but are such families good for children? Our guest has had the audacity to ask just that question in a scientifically rigorous way, and he's taken some heat for it, as you might guess. Mark Regnerus is professor of sociology at the University of Texas at Austin. His research is in the area of sexual behavior, family, marriage, and religion. He's the author of more than 40 published articles and book chapters and 3 books. Among them, Premarital Sex in America, How Young Americans Meet, Mate, and Think About Marriage. And his most recent is Cheap Sex and the Transformation of Men, Marriage, and Monogamy. Mark Regnerus, thank you for being with us.
Thanks. Good to be here.
You're also a fellow at the Augustine Institute.
Nope, the Austin Institute.
The Austin Institute. I beg your pardon. but you are a fellow.
I am.
Okay, so you did this study a few years ago. You told me just before we came on the air, 6 years ago.
Let's see. It was published in June or July of 2012.
Right? The name of the study is the New Family Structures Study. So what was it? What did it find?
Right. That was the name of the data collection project. The actual article is named something a little bit different. What did it find? Okay, so it was an attempt to collect a large sample, the largest that we could get a hold of parents, of young adults who had the parents had been in a same-sex relationship at some point in their children's growing up years, okay? So I can get as detailed about this stuff as you want because a lot of the controversy happens because of what's going on in the weeds around here. So that was the study. We managed to get, I believe, 248 cases of young adults between the ages of 18 and 39 who said on the survey that their mother or father had been in a same-sex relationship at some point while they were growing up. A lot of those relationships did not last a very long time, which became part of the controversy. I mean,
oh, I see.
Lots of different things became part of the controversy. But in the background is this attempt that we're trying to do to locate as many of these cases randomly as possible, because a lot of the literature that had come before this, social science literature, had focused on what we call snowball samples, right? So you advertise in a bookstore. In fact, one of the most famous studies that's still ongoing started with advertising in lesbian bookstores in San Francisco, Washington, and Boston, I believe. You know, it's kind of rip off that piece of paper and call them if this fits you. And I don't remember if there was an incentive to participating, but that's a non-random way to go about finding your population, right? And social science typically privileges the idea of finding a random sample, right? Because that really gives us a portrait of what's going on in a population, right? So
yes.
The point of this was to always to be random sample, right? Because that would be an improvement on what had come before it. There had only been one study of any size that had focused on a random sample prior to this. There have been a couple others that were, less than 100 cases. We had 248, which was a big improvement.
Okay, so my guess is, and maybe you don't want to speak to this, but had you found that children who were raised in a family in which one or more of their parents had a homosexual relationship mm-hmm. during the time they were being raised, had you found that that was a healthy thing, I imagine you'd have been on the cover of Time magazine and you'd been the first story on CBS News. You
probably
didn't find that, though, did you?
Well, I told the funding agency, I'm going to report to you what I see. And they said, fine, that's all we're asking for. So what did we see? Kids who had this experience in their lives. And to be fair, those experiences, some of them it was a longer period of time. Some of it was a shorter period of time. Sometimes they lived with mom and her partner or dad and his partner. That was fairly rare on the latter for varying lengths of duration. So how did they look? We had 40 outcome measures we looked at, both what's going on now that you're somewhere between 18 and 39 – and what happened in the past? Tell us to reflect on what was going on when you were growing up. Out of 40 different outcomes, I believe it was 24 or 25 different measures of those 40, you had those young adults, I call them kids, but they're young adults at that time, fared worse than a married, consistently stably married mother and biological mother and father. They tended to fare worse than some other types of broken families as well. And so there was part of the controversy was, oh, you're comparing them against some sort of gold standard. I mean, I had said the term gold standard, and I took some flack for that too. I was like, well, you know, if they look the best, then I guess they're the gold standard, right?
Yeah, right.
But part of the dirty secret here is that for years they had been compared to other kinds of broken families, right?
Yeah.
So even in some of the early random studies that were smallish, they were compared with kids who were in step families or kids who were in single mother families. And I had pooled them together, even though some of them had single mothers, some of them were in step families. A lot of them, I think, were in single mother families at that point. And you know, they fare more similar to types of relationships, parental family relationships that are exhibit some degree of brokenness in the past or in the present. So yeah, they looked different, right? The ones who reported a mother and her partner looked there was more significant differences between them and married moms and dads than there was between gay father and his partner, partly because that was a much less common occurrence. And so when you start to get a smaller number of those, I forget exactly now what the number was. I think it was 65 cases. I mean, you're losing what we call statistical power to detect real differences, right? And so it's not surprising that you don't have as many statistically significant differences at that point. So, yeah. And
So you do this study. The primary thing you're trying to get is a random sample that you can study. You study the sample. You find that it appears that there are greater negative outcomes for children whose parents have had a homosexual relationship during the time the child was being raised. Yeah. But the study is published at just the moment when American culture is making a choice, although we can debate, I suppose, whether we in the end got to make a choice about this, but was making a choice about gay marriage. And did you find yourself accused of bigotry or trying to make the lives of gay people worse?
Yes.
And
let me count the ways. That was a very difficult several years, frankly. Accusations at the beginning. Well, they started within 6 hours of the publication of the article, and it didn't let up for quite some time. I went under inquiry at the University of Texas for scientific misconduct within a month or 6 weeks of the publication of the article. You know, I was like a deer in headlight at that point, like, what on earth is going on, right? I mean, I knew there'd be pushback, but it wasn't the first sensitive piece of research that I had published. But it was, you know, some friends of mine said, Mark, this is like the third rail, right? You're combining a study of gay and lesbian parents. You've got issues about parenting. You have issues about children's flourishing. Like any one of those can get people worked up, and then you've combined them all together. So, yeah, that was something.
So you faced an investigation of sorts at the university.
Yeah, technically they don't call it an investigation because it didn't move to that level. But it was called an inquiry.
And they found there's really no basis accuse you of.
They just dismissed it after, I don't know, I had to do I had to answer 8 questions that were posed by a gay New York City blogger. In front of the research integrity officer and a group of 6, I think, department chairs. So all very surreal.
It sounds a little bit surreal, frankly. And is this a symptom of an ailment in the social sciences? Because I imagine you're familiar with the Jonathan Haidt thing.
Haidt.
He stood up in front of the largest annual collection, I think, of psychologists, mm-hmm. yep. Of a certain type of psychologist, social psychologist, and he said, he asked for a show of hands, admittedly not a scientific study, but right. how many of you are liberals, how many conservatives, how many libertarians? And he found 1% of them raised their hands to be conservatives, like something like 2% for libertarians, 80% raised their hand at being liberals. This led to further studies, and it suggests a kind of maybe that the social sciences are being led by a self-selected body of liberals. Am I correct in that or wrong?
Well, I think that's the case, but it's been that case a long time. One of the things that has changed is I think we're dealing with a little bit different kind of liberal now, frankly.
Oh, okay.
So some of my colleagues and peers have retired and passed away. When I got there in 2002, there was still plenty of them around, and they're slowly dwindling in number. And they were, frankly, a more generous kind of liberal. I mean, it was liberal in the classic sense of the term.
Yeah, right? Let's find out the truth kind of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So okay. I enjoyed them as colleagues very much. That's not the next gen of liberal, essentially, people who are probably under age 60 now, I'd say.
Uh-huh.
Certainly 55 and down. And so there's a great deal of self-selectivity. There always has been.
Yeah.
But there was an atmosphere in which this was you could study different things. You could make a little bit bolder claims. And it was also pre-social media era too. I mean, now you are judged and are charged, judged, and executed in social media within days of publishing something. It's really not conducive to the sort of slow accumulation of empirical accuracy.
Have you heard the term activist scholar? Have you ever heard that phrase?
I have, yeah.
And are you
some people would say I am one of those, right?
Okay, all right, fair enough. Right. Are you an activist scholar?
I don't think of myself that way.
Okay.
I write about things that matter to me, but I think the term activist scholar, you have this idea that somehow you are bending the facts.
Yes, right.
To a political project, and I've never felt like I've bent facts, right?
Right.
There are ways that you can present facts that shed greater or worse light on your pet projects, perhaps. But I mean, that's not bending the truth. That is the presentation of data, so to speak.
Right.
So somebody can say and did say about the NFSS study, like, Mark, if you had crunched the numbers this way, and you had controlled for family instability because most of these households were unstable, right? If you had controlled for poverty, and because most of the two women households were poorer on average, then some of those statistically significant effects would disappear. And I kept saying in print, well, this is part of the pathway of how kids are raised and how they flourish. And so why would I want to get rid of the pathways in order to prove a pet theory, perhaps, right?
Oh, I see.
So I think that the best way that I do my work, and I recommend it for other social scientists, is you first start with the basic sort of simple associations between one thing and another, right? So that's what I started in that paper. What do kids who grew up with a mom or a dad who had been in a same-sex relationship look like on these 40 different outcomes? Just a straight-up, we call it bivariate association. The percent of kids in that situation who reported receiving community or public assistance as kids. I mean, it was 70%, I believe, if their mother had been in a same-sex relationship. Whereas compared to, I think it was 10% if you were in a married, stable mom and dad family, right? So then you build from that to adding some controls, right? Regression models and things like that, and it gets a little more complicated as you tell a grander story of what's going on, right?
Yes.
And okay. That one of the secrets of this science has been that we don't want to tell the big picture story. We want to cut as quickly as we can to the sculpted kind of models that tell the kind of story we want to. My colleagues, they would never admit this, but that's when I look at the science, that's what it is, right? They cut straight to complexity, right? Because complexity hides basic
what's actually happening
truths.
In the world.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
Okay. Fair enough. So so I assume now that having gone through this experience and the vilification that came with it, you will be doing lots more of these studies of. Am I missing something?
You know, it's funny. Like I had said, I was not intending to stay in that particular domain of research for long, and I didn't. Although I'm starting to get back into it. I mean, there's larger and better data out there now.
Yeah.
That a lot of people have been dabbling in, and again, a lot of them cut quickly to complexity. And I'm like, okay, we have to start with simplicity and then build towards complexity. And understanding and explaining how these relationships produce what kind of child outcomes. So that data is federally funded. Part of the thing, and this is a benefit, and some conservatives don't like this, but when on large surveys we're asked questions about sexual identity and things like that, I think it's – I find it helpful because now I'm a little bit more on an even playing field mm-hmm. with some of my intellectual opponents, right? We can all look at the same data, right?
Yes.
So one of the things about the NFSS study, which was – I made the data public within a few months of that publication. Other people could see it too, right? Yeah. They could replicate the study. One of the things that I hold is that all of these data sets, whether they're federally funded or privately funded, if they're nationally representative, random samples, we're all seeing the same thing.
Right.
It's just a matter of how are you presenting the data
yes.
right, to
yeah.
the public?
That brings up a recollection of something about lies and damn lies and statistics. But yeah, I'm sure you've
right.
heard that many times. But so since your study, and again, the name of the underlying study, the New Family Structures study, was mm-hmm. Have there been bigger, grander studies that have
right.
looked in the same area? And are we finding that children raised in, for example, mm-hmm. Homes of two gay partners are flourishing or not flourishing?
Right.
What are we finding?
Well, there is a spectrum to this, too.
Okay.
I mean, so the longer you stay in a household and if there's stability in the union, the better kids look. And one of the things, too, here is that gay men's unions first of all, they tend not to have children. If they do have children, typically by adoption or surrogacy, the men tend to be professionals and well-paid. I mean, the Department of Treasury, I think it was 2016, revealed the tax returns totals for gay men filing jointly, I believe. And it was $250,000 on average. I mean, I know
they're
this is
right.
California, but still, like that, yeah. that's stunning. That was
you can rent a
well
studio
over
for that.
Double.
You're in California, but yeah,
well over double what it was for married right. Mom and dad filing jointly. So
I see.
So money helps with children, right? I mean,
right.
it buys you access to educational experiences, tutors, all sorts of things. So. There's that. But the data is the best data right now, I think, is called the National Health Information Survey. Father Paul Sullins, who is a sociologist professor at Catholic University of America in D.C., has been analyzing that. And he's, he kind of replaced me in some ways in terms of duking out with some of our
he's the bad guy now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Except that, he was never considered as bad as me, partly because he never collected his own data, which is neither here nor there, but like, I was the kind of the sapper or the pathfinder who
yeah.
who gets blown up by the landmines, and then he came after me, and I think he's done a great job. And so he dukes it out with, and again, it's all about not what the data says; it's how you present the data.
Mm-hmm.
So he finds that it is a problem on average. So.
Fair enough. Mark Regneris is our guest. Mark is a professor of sociology at the University of Texas in Austin and a fellow at the Austin Institute. You can find out more about him at markregneris.com. That's R-E-G-N-E-R-U-S. Is that correct?
That's right.
.com. Thank you, Dr. Regneris. We're going to have to take a break now. We'll continue this conversation next week where I'd like to get into your current research in sexuality, in marriage, and particularly in the future of Christian marriage. Thanks so much for listening to Catholic Answers Focus. I am Cy Kellett, your host. And if you enjoy these podcasts, don't forget to tell your friends that they can join Radio Club and get the weekly update on which focus has been posted. You join Radio Club just by going to CatholicAnswersLive.com and signing up. We'll see you next time on Catholic Answers Focus.